On this computer. Okay.
You want a drink? It's good, yeah.
Right. Well, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. This is the second to last shiur in the series on the Avos. I've had a wonderful time learning with you all. Thank you for sticking through, and thank you to everybody who was able to come as well on Zoom. I really appreciate it. So up until now, we've had two basic parts to the series. The first was establishing how Matan Torah was the beginning of the Jewish nation, right? That's what Rav Soloveitchik said, from people to nation occurred at Matan Torah. As we said from Rav Lichtenstein and the Ramban, that we established a two-way relationship between us and Hashem at Matan Torah. And before that, the Avos were just volunteering, which was very nice, but it wasn't the connection and relationship that Hashem wanted to ultimately happen. And then over the last two shiurim, we spoke about, well, what then did the Avos contribute? So the Avos contributed, as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, the essence of the Jewish people. The way Rav Shlomo Fisher described it, based on the Granat, was that they contributed the Jewish ethnicity, which is linked to a certain cultural heritage, certain midos and character traits that are so central to the Jewish people that they persist in all circumstances and all environments throughout history. And then finally, in the last shiur, we said, okay, so what? What do those midos mean for us? And we used the letters and writings and the correspondence course that Rav Dessler gave to his students when they were evacuated from London during the Blitzkrieg about Zuchus Avos and Bris Avos. And so we focused on how Zuchus Avos might be used up, Bris Avos will never be used up. And what he explained and what Rav Tzadok explained is that it doesn't just mean you get a free pass because our ancestors were good. What it means is that we have a certain atmosphere and heritage that makes it easier for us to correct certain behaviors. And so Hashem is more lenient with us, not because we're favorites, but because we have a lot going for us. And then Rav Dessler and Rav Tzadok took it a step forward and said, well, theoretically, if you walk away from everything, then chas v'shalom, that bris won't help anymore. So what Hashem did is, with this covenant, Rav Tzadok says, is that God essentially promised to intervene throughout history, that no matter what happens, God will make sure that the Jewish people as a nation will never deviate from those midos or the core character traits of the Jewish people, so that the merit and covenant will always persist. That's what we've said up until now. What I want to do this week is to kind of connect the two parts, to connect the Matan Torah and the Avos part. We essentially talked about two covenants. We talked about Bris Avos, and we also talked about another covenant. We never used this terminology, but it's called Bris Sinai. We have a covenant based off of the Torah. There are a lot of covenants in the Torah, and we'll learn about a few today. But what I want to do is kind of study the relationship between the two of them, meaning what connection or what is the relationship between what the Avos contributed and what the Torah contributed? How do they kind of work together? Yeah. Ah, so that's an interesting question. So yes, as you pointed out, there is, we say in Slichos, Bris Shlosh Esrei, referring to the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim. We also have, in conjunction with that, we read for the Kriyas HaTorah on a public fast day, we say, Hinei Anochi Koreis Bris. So God is making a covenant. And what Rashi and the Mefarshim say is, the first one didn't go so well with the Egel, so God's making a new one. And he lists a collection of certain laws. Some of them, you know, make sense why they're there, and some of them seem like a bit odd why they're there. So there are multiple iterations of a covenant. So we have the Yud Gimel Midos, we have the second set of Luchos. Later on in Sefer Dvarim, we have another covenant that Hashem describes. Well, first of all, we have one that actually took place during the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, which was Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kolchem. We're all entering into a bris. And then Moshe says, when you cross the Yarden, we're going to do another bris on Har Grizim and Har Eval. So there are multiple iterations. One of my Rebbeim in Eretz Yisrael, Moshe Staff, so he actually spoke about all the different covenants and how they relate to each other. That's far beyond the scope of what I can do in one shir. But as we'll see, what I want to show you is that all of those other ones can be grouped into what I would call the larger catch-all of Bris Sinai. So I don't mean a particular one. I essentially mean anything that's post-Sinai. It has a certain type of covenant that we can connect back to Har Sinai. And every covenant that happened before Har Sinai has a different flavor to it. This is based off of a shir that I read. I'm assuming he's a Rebbe in Gush or affiliated with Gush. He posted certain materials on VBM, but you don't have to be faculty there. So I'm not sure if he teaches in Gush or Herzog or Migdal Oz, but a lot of this comes from there. So what I want to talk about first is let's go to Tanakh and see the first time we have a pre-Sinai covenant, namely the Bris Bein HaBesarim. So I'm going to share the screen so people can also see the source sheets on Zoom. Give me one second here. So this is, if you look at source number one, this is essentially all of Perek Tesvav or a lot of Perek Tesvav in Bereishis, which talks about the Bris Bein HaBesarim. And so if you look on the top, so there's a picture of a guy, Avraham, and he has a contract that says Bris. And the question is, okay, fine, so he's got a contract. The question is, what does it say? What exactly is the Bris Bein HaBesarim? As you'll see, there's a lot of stuff here. And the question is, well, what's the covenant and what's not the covenant? So let's just take a look. So this takes place after the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings. And for some reason, Avraham is scared. He used up his merits. And so Hashem says, don't worry, Avram. I'll protect you. And you have a lot of reward. And so then Avram says, well, you gave me a lot of stuff, but I have no kids, and Eliezer is going to be the one to inherit me. And Hashem says, don't worry, you'll have a kid. And then in Pasuk Hey, it says Hashem took him outside, and Hashem says, you'll have a lot of kids. And then in Pasuk Vav, it says, Be'emin ba'Hashem, he believed in Hashem, v'yachshevei lo tzedakah, and God considered that as righteousness. So he displayed a certain amount of faith to Hashem, and Hashem said, okay, this is good. Yeah. Yes, so that is a very interesting inference, that the language, the conjugation, is hifil causative, as opposed to what I would say is by what's it called? By Shiras Hayam, by Aminu Bashem of Moshe Avdo. There, that's just direct. They believed. Here, it's Avram caused himself to believe. So what I would say is that either Avram needed to kind of psych himself up to believe, or the Yamin Bashem of Moshe Avdo is based on stuff that they saw, meaning they saw stuff, as opposed to over here where Avram's just believing. So it might just be a technical thing that if you're believing something in the future, you need to cause yourself because you have nothing to work off of other than faith. So I'm not sure. You could say either way, but it's a very good inference. But regardless, after Hashem considers this to be a display of righteousness, that triggers the rest of the parak. And the rest of the parak goes as follows. Hashem says, I am Hashem who took you out of Ur Kasdim to give you this land. And then Avram seems to backtrack and he says, well, how do I know that I'm going to inherit? And I don't have this as a source here, but the Gemara in Megillah, I forget what daf, I want to say Gimel, but I really don't remember. The Gemara in Megillah says, Bameh Eda, Avram basically says, well, what if my kids sin? You know, I'm righteous, so I get Eretz Yisrael, but what are my kids going to do if they sin? And what Hashem responds is, Hashem responds by saying, in the next pasuk, take animals and we'll make a covenant. So for Avram, this was a covenant, but the Gemara in Megillah says that this alludes to karbanos. So Hashem says, don't worry, Avraham. If they sin, they can bring karbanos. And so it's very interesting. We're about to have the Bris Bein HaBesarim, and the vehicle for making a covenant, which is supposed to be something that can't be broken, is Avram backpedaling and says, well, maybe it's not going to work out. And Hashem says, don't worry, this covenant, the Karbanos, will make it that I'll never be able to back out. And so once again, we see the dynamic of a bris. Avraham believes in Hashem, but he's scared that his kids are not. And so Hashem says, don't worry, have Karbanos and it'll work out. So Avram does that. Then we go to Pasuk Yud Gimel. So Avraham, you know, the sun sets, he goes into a trance. There's this darkness. Medrash says it alludes to Golos, to exile. And then Hashem speaks. Vayomer la'Avram, and he says to Avram, Yado ateida ki ger yizaracha be'eretz lo lahem, va'avadum vi'inu osam arba me'al shana. So you're going to be strangers, you're going to be in exile, and then for 400 years, and then it says, v'gam es ha'goy asher yavdu, don anochi v'achrechen yatsu b'rchush gada. Afterwards, though, I'm going to, you know, judge them, I'm going to judge their oppressors, and I'll take them out with great reward. You'll die in peace. Vidor Revi Yeshuvu Hena, and the fourth generation will return here. So then, if we continue in Pasuk Yud Zayin, there's a fire that passes through, symbolizing Hashem passing through this covenant. And then in Pasuk Yud Ches, we get to the bris. Bayom Ahu Karas Hashem Es Avram Bris. So God made a bris. Lemor. So what's the bris? So I'm going to give you the land of Israel. And then it says the land of the Keni, the Knizi, the Kadmoni, etc. And then the rest of the parak is just listing all the lands and nationalities that Hashem will give them dominion over. So if that's it. That's the end of the parak. We just did a parak of Rashis. So if I had to say, sum up in one sentence, what is the covenant? It's very interesting because the covenant says one thing. And, you know, if you go back, Avram talks about that thing, but he kind of interjects something else as well. So what is the main thing of the covenant? Land. Yeah. God says, I'm giving you land. Now, there's stuff that happens beforehand, too. God adds in other stuff beforehand. It's not in the verse of you're getting land, but he adds in other stuff. What else is mentioned in this parak that maybe is part of the bris, maybe is not part of the bris? I'm sorry? Children. Yeah, progeny. So another element is kids. You know, Avraham said, how do I know I'm not going to have, I don't have any kids to inherit. And Hashem says, don't worry, you'll have. He believes in that. And once he believes in that, that triggers the covenant. And in the covenant it includes kids. But it's more of like an afterthought. You know, you need kids to inherit the land. There's one other element. It's not mentioned in that pasuk, but it's mentioned earlier. Exile. Exile. It's not mentioned in the covenant, but for some reason, Hashem interjects it. So the Gemara actually says that this was because Avram said, Bama Eda, because Avram questioned it, Hashem said, you know, they're going to have to go through an exile to purify themselves of that. If we just take the simple pshat, I don't think it contradicts it, but if we just have the simple pshat, it seems to be like a condition, but not really a condition. It seems to be a prerequisite. In order to get the land, you need to go through exile. The covenant is very simply land. But then if you take a step back to the Yado Ateda, God's just saying, your kids are going to go into exile and then you're going to, you know, leave with wealth and then you're going to get land. So that's basically the Bris Bein HaBesarim. This is a example of the most famous and most primary covenant before Sinai. Now let's go to the covenants after Sinai and we'll see that there is one major difference. So the first one is not actually after Sinai, but it's at Har Sinai. So let's look at source number two. This is in Parshas Yisro. This is in Parshas Bishalach. This is after the Jewish people got to Mara. And as we'll see, and as the Pasuk says, Shom Sam Lo Choku Mishpat. So they got Torah. So this is already the beginning of the Torah type of relationship. And so Hashem says something. Vayomer, Im shamo atishma lekol Hashem elokecha vahayashar be'enav ta'aseh. If you listen and you do what's proper, b'shamarta kol chukav, and you keep all of his mitzvos, kol amach l'asher samti b'mitzrayim lo osim alecha ki ani Hashem rofecha. I won't put any of the makos that I gave to Mitzrayim. So, aside from mitzvos, now factoring into the equation, so that's obviously one difference. There's another very significant difference about this type of covenant and the covenant with Avraham. What's one major difference? What do you mean by straightforward? Yeah.
This is tit-tat.
Yeah, this is, there's conditionality here. If you listen, then good. And if you don't listen, then not good. As opposed to by the Bris Bein HaBesharim, where, that's where it gets a little bit nuanced. It's not all good, meaning he says, Yodoa Teda, you're going to be enslaved. Right, it's unidirectional. God's just saying, this is going to happen, bad, then good. That's just going to happen. So there's one of the changes of pre-Sinai to post-Sinai is conditionality. And this is not just a one-time occurrence. If you look, all of the rest of the covenants are conditional. This one is right before Har Sinai, Va'ata, Im Shamoa Tishma'u B'Koli, Ushamar Temes B'Risi V'Yisem Lisagula Mikol HaAmim. Once again, if you listen, then you'll be treasured. Number four, Im B'Chukosai Teilech V'Im Lo Tishma. Again, you know, one after another. And then finally, the one by Dvarim. This is the one with Moshe. V'haya Im Shamoa Tishma B'Kol HaShem Elokecha. V'haya Im Lo Tishma. And then finally, the parak ends with the Tochacha. Eile divrei habris asher tziva Hashem es Moshe lichros es bnei Yisrael beretz Moav milvad habris asher karasi tam bechoreif. All of this is a continuation of the bris in Choreif, and it's all with the word im. If this good, if this bad. And so this is one major distinction between the two covenants. We have two paradigms of covenants. One is conditionality, and one is just stating the facts. And what's very interesting is that this is not only something that's unique to the Torah. There's a journal article, which I don't know this person. It's written a while ago, I think in the 60s maybe or 50s. It's an article from the Journal of the American Oriental Society. His name is Weinfeld. I think he was a professor at Hebrew University. I don't advocate reading all of his stuff because part of the rest of the article, some other parts of the article, I think we would consider to be heretical. But there's a very interesting idea that he puts forth and says that there are two types of brisim in the Torah, and they model two different types of secular political covenants that were made at that time. So if you see, this is a picture of a big stone. This stone was essentially like a border for a person's property, that you would put it on your territory to mark your territory, and it had writing from the king. So let's just take a look at the article because it's very important. He says two types of covenants occur in the Old Testament, the obligatory type reflected in the Sinai covenant and the promissory type reflected in the covenants with Avraham and David. So I didn't show you this, but you know, there's another bris that HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes with David, which says that the Malchus will never leave you, as opposed to Shaul, who sinned and it gets taken away, or the Malchai Yisrael, who sin and it gets taken away. With Malchai Yehuda, they can sin and they'll get punished and they'll get exiled, but the Lo Yasser Shevet Mi Yehuda, the monarchy will never depart from David HaMelech. So he says two types of official judicial documents had been diffused in Mesopotamian cultural sphere from the middle of the second millennium onward. So there were two types of treaties. The political treaty, which is well known to us from the Hittite Empire, and the royal grant, which is what this stone is, the classical form of which is found in the Babylonian Kuduru documents, boundary stones. The structure of both types of these documents is similar. Functionally, however, there is a vast difference between these two types of documents. And here we get to the core of it. While the treaty constitutes an obligation of the vassal to his master, the Caesarian, the grant constitutes an obligation of the master to his servant. In the grant, the curse is directed towards the one who will violate the rights of the king's vassals, meaning if you harm these people, the king will exact justice. While in the treaty, the curse is directed towards the vassal who will violate the rights of the king. A treaty is, you have an obligation to the melech and you need to do it, and if not, the melech will punish you. In other words, the grant serves mainly the right to protect the servant, while the treaty comes to protect the rights of the masters. What is more, while the grant is a reward for loyalty and good deeds already performed, the treaty is an inducement for future loyalty. And so now he connects it back to the two brisim of Avraham Avraham and David versus Bris Sinai. So the bris with Avraham and David belong to the grant type. So like the royal grants of in the Near East, so also belong to the grant type and not, so also the covenants with Abraham and David are gifts bestowed upon individuals who excelled in loyally serving their master. So that's the He'emin Bashem, Bayich Shaveha, Staka. So that's what he says. This is an example of a grant type of treaty. Now there's one difference though. And this is the real clincher. He says there's a difference between these two treaties. Because one is forward focused, it could be taken away. He says, if you don't behave for a treaty, then the king's going to punish you. And if you commit treason, the king gets your property. But for a grant, he says, your descendants can do whatever you want to the king. You can be the most traitorous people and they can punish you. That land can never be seized by the government. That land will always be in that family. So in the very last sentence, he says, contrary to the prevalent law in the Hittite kingdom, according to which the property of the condemned is to be confiscated, in the cited documents, meaning these big stones, the property of the condemned cannot be taken away. So this is an example of what Bris Avos was modeled after, meaning the way Hashem structured the Bris was in a way familiar with what the Jewish people and society at that time had. Bris Sinai is forward focused. It's conditional and it could be taken away. Meaning if the Jewish people sin, then they get punished. But Bris Avos, Hashem is saying, we'll come up with something, whether it be karbanos, whether it be davening, we'll figure out some way that this can never be taken away. That's why there's no conditionality there. So that explains the difference between these two brisim. But we know, and this is a rule, there's no such thing as a free lunch in Judaism. There is no such thing as, yeah. Well, somebody's got to sponsor the kiddush. Even the RJC sponsors the kiddush. Someone's got to pay for it. Only, you know, in the news, I don't know if you read, they claim that they discovered nuclear fission so they can make something out of nothing, some yesh mayayin type of thing. But, you know, when it comes to Judaism, we don't believe that. We don't believe that you get free reward. And so the question is then, well, what does that mean then? Just because Avraham was loyal, why does that mean that God will just promise that this will never happen? Essentially, where is the buy-in of the Jewish people? There has to be some element of conditionality that motivates God to intervene in history, that motivates God to ensure that we will never deviate from the others. So to answer that question, let's look at a person who may have been part of that covenant and walked away from it. So let's look at source number 7 from last week's parsha. Vayikach Esav es nashav ve'es banav ve'es benosav ve'es kol nafshos beiso ve'es miknehu ve'es kol behemto ve'es kol kinyano asher rochash be'eretz Kenan. He took everything from Canaan that Hashem had promised to his father and to his grandfather. Vayelech el eretz mipnei Yaakov achiv. And he left. He went to Seir because of Yaakov, his brother. So what does that mean? Mipnei Yaakov achiv. So Rashi gives two explanations. The first one is not here, which is just, you know, there was just like Avraham and Lot that it was too densely populated. But then there's a Medrash Agada. Mipnei shtar chov shel gzeiras kiger yazaracha hamutal al zaro shel Yitzchak. Why did he leave? Because of his brother Yaakov? It's because of that obligatory contract of the decree of exile in Mitzrayim, Hamutal al Zarosh Yitzchak, that was hanging over the children of Yitzchak. Omar Eilech Limikan, I'm getting out of here. Ein li lo chelek b'matana shenitna lo ha'aretz hazos. I don't want to have any portion in this gift of getting the land. V'lo b'paraon hashtar. And I don't want to have to deal with having to pay the bill. So what does this medrash say? Or what is this? What is Rashi quoting this medrash? That there is a certain conditionality, but the conditionality is a different type. The Bris Sinai is, okay, if you want Hashem to act one way to you, you have to do this. If not, then Hashem's going to act another way. Over here, this is just a demonstration of loyalty, right? The land grant is a demonstration of loyalty. And Hashem said, if you're loyal to me, then this is what's going to happen. You're going to have to pay a cost. You're going to have to go through what the Medrash describes as a Kur HaBarzel that will refine the character of the Jewish people through slavery. Somehow it will elevate the Jewish people. And that's the only way you're going to get Eretz Yisrael. I have this dream and enterprise. And if you want to be part of it, this is how it goes. And so you can opt in or opt out. And that's essentially the conditionality. It's not how you act within the covenant, but it's whether you want to be part of the covenant at all. When it came to Bris Sinai, the Jewish people didn't have a choice. God said, I'm going to drop this mountain on you if you don't accept it. The choice comes after the covenant, which side we play. But when it comes to the Bris Avos, we had the option of opting in or opting out. Yeah.
Is there a similar event to Yaakov where he quote-unquote opts in?
So that it's very interesting as to how Yaakov decides to opt in. I would say, it's not a shir about Yaakov, but if I had to say, you can probably point to a couple of places where Yaakov does opt in. The first time I would say is when he decides to get the brachos and the bechora. The second time is when he encounters and has that dream with the ladder, and he makes a pact with God, that he makes an oath. The next time is when he has that dream and he comes home. How his relationship with God is during Yosef's time is hard to describe, but when he's going down to Mitzrayim, Hashem comes and reassures him. There was some angst, and then Yaakov wakes up and he's okay. So there are a lot of times, Yaakov is described as being perpetually afraid. Ashrei Adam Mefached Tamid is a reference to Yaakov, the Gemara says. So Yaakov is always afraid, and when he talks with Hashem, Hashem always reassures him, even though life's hard. And so Yaakov's, I guess, catharsis each time and acting on that is his opting in. That's what I would say in the shorthand. But again, there's a lot more nuance to it. But anyway, so just going back now, so that's really the relationship, that's really the difference between Bris Avos and Bris Sinai. Bris Sinai is conditionality within the covenant, and Bris Avos is the conditionality is whether you want to be part of it or not. So now we come to the part that I got from the Rebbe, who I think is in Gush. His name is Rabbi Yehuda Goldberg. He has a couple of essays about Bris Avos and Bris Sinai. I think he's American, or at least he was educated in, you know, Western liberal arts, because he draws a parallel between the U.S. Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. But he says, Biyasoda, I'm not going to read the whole thing in Hebrew just because it'll take too long, but he says, Biyasoda, shel Bris Sinai omdim chukim. The foundations of Bris Sinai are laws, and Biyasoda shel Bris Avos omdim arachim. The foundation of Bris Avos are values. And again, if you think back to the terminology of the Granad of Rav Dessler and Rav Tzadok, essentially midos, or not just midos of Ben Adam Lechavero, but essentially God's enterprise. So he says Bris Sinai takes the form of a contract, right? We have expectations. If you want to do this, you get rewarded. If you don't do it, you get punished. And then he says, about halfway through, he says both sides recognize a common interest, though everyone can come from a different direction, meaning God has an agenda and we have an agenda. They do not have to adopt a common vision, and they can remain neutral and even hostile to each other, right? So in a country, you have Democrats, Republicans, Independents. assuming that we're all law-abiding citizens, we all follow the laws, even though we follow them for different reasons. Some of the laws we believe in, some of them we disagree with, but we still follow because we believe that it's important to have an organized society. And some people do because they don't want to get whacked by the policeman. And so what he says is, Hachoze, in the bolded part, Matziv Raf Tachton, Lo Elyon, the contract sets a bottom line, not a top one. It sets a floor and not a ceiling. V'zu b'diyuk hasiba l'kach shehatna'im v'hasanktziot, sanctions, b'yachas l'chol tzad nekuvim b'tzura ko nukshah. And he says, that's why when it comes to Bris Sinai, all of the rewards and punishments are so clearly hammered out. He says, because this is a set of laws. This is a contract where you don't have to like it. This is just God is essentially laying out a framework for two different parties to get along. It's a political treaty, right? Political treaties, if you go back to that journal article in the Middle East, as we very well know, when we sign treaties in the Middle East, it's not only because we have goodwill and we want to, and we like each other and we agree with each other. It's that we want to coexist, or we have a common enemy, or we're just afraid we're going to attack each other and waste all of our resources, but we can disagree. And so the contract or the treaty sets the bottom line. Bris Avos, though, in the second box, Bris Avos Lumazos, Matziga Ma She'onu Hayinu Mechanim Bris Bimuvan Hamiluli. The Bris Avos is what we colloquially refer to as a Bris. Bris Matziva Lo Rak Al Heskem. A covenant is not just an agreement. Ela Al Sug Shel Yichud Bein Hatzdadim, but a kind of union between the parties. Bris soveves saviv chazon mishutaf. A covenant is comprised of a united vision. Matara mishutefet, a joint purpose. Hama'anika et hashra'a lemesima shel shnehem. A common goal that inspires both of them. Brit amnam matila mechuyavim al kaltzad. Obviously, a covenant can impose obligations. Ach mechuyaviyot elu. Should be elu. But the obligatoriness that stems from this covenant, novot beofen tivi mi ekronot hayisod, meaning they're not just these like arbitrary obligations that we just have to agree upon in order to function, but these obligations from a covenant naturally, organically emerge from the shared vision, and that's the ikar, that's the primary thing. Shishnei atzadim ma'amtzim yachad, that they're trying to do together. And that's why by Bris Avos, it doesn't spell out everything, because that's not the point. Obviously, there are obligations, whether you want to be part of this, whether you're going to go down to Egypt, whether you're going to follow in the path of Avraham and Yitzchak and follow those mitos. But that's not the point of it. That's the point of Bris Sinai, to hammer it out. The point of Bris Avos is God saying, I have this vision, I have this dream, do you want to be part of it? And so now he connects it to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And so he says, "Kamuvan chozim ubritot mashlimim elu et elu." And he says that, you know, just for the very fact that they exist together nowadays shows that they complement each other. He says two parties united for a common purpose may choose to strengthen their partnership through explicit wordings of contractual terms. And to increase one's participation. But the main thing is the vision, is the values. And so he says a classic example of this in American history is the complementary role of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Now, again, he's not a law professor. He's not an American historian. There are many views about the relationship between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I would say this is probably the Federalist opinion. I have a quotation in source number 10 from a member of the Federalist Society who essentially says this. I'm sure there are people that disagree. But he says, a classic example in American history is the complementary role of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence, as its name implies, outlines the key principles that forced the original colonies to disengage from the British Crown and around which they united to form a new entity. The Constitution, on the other hand, gives solid state laws that govern the state, even if from time to time, the Declaration of Independence does not apply equally. So he has a very interesting way of formulating it, but essentially he's saying the Declaration of Independence was the motivation and the dream and the values, and the Constitution, and apparently even the Bill of Rights, according to him, are laws and conditions that will formally enforce people to abide by that vision of the Declaration of Independence, even if they don't necessarily agree with it, at all times and at all places in history. And so just before we take a step back, just to show you this fellow, Rob Nadelson, I think he's a law professor and also a member of the Federalist Society. This is not a journal article. This is like a popular thing that he wrote for July 4th. He says the Declaration of Independence is a statement based on fundamental principles of justice and right. The Constitution, on the other hand, is a statement of positive law, consisting of rules enforceable by governmental authority. And so even after independence, the Declaration remained as a statement of America's natural law ideals. The Constitution was adopted to move American law closer to those ideals. The Constitution did this in two ways, rules and procedures. And so according to this model that Rabbi Goldberg is trying to argue, Bris Avos never went away, and Bris Sinai is not necessarily better. It's right. You could say it superimposes. It fills in a certain need. What's very interesting is that, you know, you could say, based on what I heard from the Ramban and from Rav Lichtenstein and from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Bris Sinai is the most important part. And what Rav Goldberg is saying is that that may be true, but that's true because we live in a certain reality, meaning the vision. That's the real thing. That's the main thing. God's vision of Kigeri Yezaracha and then Vachrechein Yatsubir Flush Gadol. You know, they went through this refining process. They came back. They took control of the land. That's the vision. That's the, you know, Sof Maaseh B'Machshava Tchila type of, you know, description. That's God's plan. But there's a lot of things that can go wrong. So, what's a very interesting question, which I don't have an answer to, is did Avraham need the Torah? And the answer is, I don't know. Meaning when Avraham said, Bama Eda Ki Arshena, how do I know that my kids aren't going to be righteous? Maybe not having the Torah was okay for Avraham because he was still fulfilling God's vision. It was voluntarily. As we said from the Rashba and from the Nefesh HaChaim, that they were just able to intuit all of this stuff. So maybe for Avram, it was enough. Maybe he didn't need the Torah. It was enough for him to have that vision. But God said, no, it may be good enough for you, but it's not going to be good enough for all generations. If we want to make this something that will last for all future generations to bind them together, we're going to have to impose certain conditions and formalize certain things in order to facilitate that vision to keep people in line. As a result of that, we have mitzvah and mitzvah. We have obligations. So it's very interesting. The necessary evil, so to speak, of Matan Torah, of formalizing religion, actually gave us a very profound connection to Hashem that Avraham didn't have. So it's just a very interesting way of looking at it, that on the one hand, the primary vision, you could argue, is the most important thing, the Declaration of Independence, the vision of getting Eretz Yisrael, the Bris Bein HaBesarim, Bris Avos, that's the most important thing. But practically speaking, God says that's not enough. We're going to need a Torah. We're going to need that two-way relationship. We can't just have volunteerism, because volunteerism ain't going to work for all of history. We're going to need a set of obligations. And that's where Bris Sinai comes in. And almost paradoxically, through Bris Sinai, according to the Ramban, we got an even closer relationship. That treaty facilitated an even closer relationship with Hashem than that promise, than that land grant of past loyalty could give Avraham. So it's just a very interesting way of looking at these, at the relationship of these two things. So which is better? You can't really answer that question. They serve two different functions. One is to outline the vision, and the other of Bris Sinai is to say, okay, now how do we do that? And the way we do that is by having a really close relationship that Avraham didn't have and maybe didn't even need. So that's the end of this year. What I hope to do next week, this was a little bit shorter than previous year, and the next week will also be a little bit shorter as well. We're going to look at another place in Tanakh. This is at the beginning of Parshas Va'era, end of Parshas Shmos, where we see the interplay at work, where we begin to see the very, very beginning stages of Bnei Yisrael evolving from Bris Avos to Bris Sina. Obviously, they didn't get the Torah then. They didn't get mitzvos then. But we'll see how individualism and, you know, one's personal relationship with God, which will ultimately be expanded to obligations and mitzvos, begins to emerge from Bris Avos. That's what I hope to learn with you next week, and that will be the end of the series. So once again, thank you so much. Some people have given me some suggestions about what to do next. I encourage you all to either come over or to email. I'm happy to take suggestions. I can't promise we'll do them. I also have to do this in consultation with the rabbi, and also I have to prepare and have what to say. But thank you all for coming and looking forward.
Thank you.
All right, have a good night. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.